the cell. NBA playoffs. Houston beat Golden State in Game 4 of their series last night, 95-92, to tie it up 2-2. Tonight, Cleveland plays in Boston. That series also tied up 2-2. The forecast now from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, May the 23rd, should be mostly sunny and very pleasant. Still a dense fog advisory till 9 this morning. Today's high 76, but cooler near Lake Michigan. A little bit of a cloud cover now, still some patchy fog here and there. 55 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. This Saturday, May 26th, Carthage College is pleased and honored to welcome to its campus one of the country's most renowned authors and historians, John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer responsible for books like American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, and Franklin and Winston. His latest book is titled The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, and in this book, John Meacham looks back at some of the most difficult chapters in our country's history, in which our nation found itself as bitterly and deeply divided as it is divided today. And it is John Meacham's contention that we can learn valuable lessons from our own past in order to find a way to rebuild trust and unity in our country today. John Meacham will be appearing in a public event Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock at Carthage's Siebert Chapel, an event which I'm very pleased and honored to be emceeing. John Meacham and I will be talking about his latest book, The Soul of America, and we will be taking some questions from the audience as well. It is a rare opportunity to be able to meet an author of his great stature. I hope that you will make a point of trying to attend this event, which again is Saturday afternoon, May 26th, 2 o'clock at Carthage's Siebert Chapel. In my recent conversation with John Meacham about his latest book, I began by asking him about the subtitle of the book, which is The Battle for Our Better Angels. The words better angels evoke memories of our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, and indeed, Abraham Lincoln referred to our better angels in his first inaugural address, which was delivered just as the country was falling apart. I asked John Meacham what about our current situation prompted him to write this book, and also how our current situation reminds him of that situation back in 1861.
It was the peroration at the just as the secession winter was coming along and the country was disintegrating. And one of the reasons my mind went to it is in any period of division and contention, which tends to be the rule rather than the exception in American life, we have to struggle to listen to those better angels. And they are there. Sometimes they seem awfully far away. But our best eras have been defined by those moments in which we have managed to more generously interpret the Jeffersonian idea of human equality, which was what Lincoln in the Maelstrom of War was trying to do.
Explain to our listeners what has prompted you to write this particular book. What about our current climate that served as sort of the most powerful galvanizing force for you to shape this narrative of our history in this way?
Well, two things. Right? There's the events in Charlottesville last August when the neo-Nazis and Klansmen marched in support of a Robert E. Lee statue and a young counter-protester was killed, and the President of the United States had a hard time figuring out which side he was on, was the immediate occasion. But more broadly, I get asked all the time, I'm sure you do, has it ever been this divided? Has it ever been so terrible? Well, yeah, Fort Sumter was pretty bad. The American Revolution itself was pretty bad in terms of Tories versus Patriots. The McCarthy era, the 1930s, 1968. If you and I had been talking 50 years ago today, 46 American servicemen died in Vietnam on an average of 46 a day, every day in 1968. So my argument is not relax, everything's going to be fine. It's let's figure out what happened in the past, learn from it, and work to make everything fine.
So in other words, everything becoming better is not an inevitability that we should just wait to happen. It's something...
No, Lord, no. I mean, the entire American story is one of difficult steps forward against extraordinary forces, often based on human appetite, ambition, a need, an understandable human impulse on the part of people who have power to keep that power. The reason the Constitution is as resilient as it is because it is a document that takes into account human frailty, human appetite, human ambition. As Madison said in Federalist 51, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. And so the system itself was designed for moments of unrest, for seasons of anger, for moments that felt as though everything was ending. And unquestionably, this is in many ways a unique time, but the underlying forces that produce this particular presidency, that produce this particular moment, are perennial ones in the American experience.
One of the key words in your book is that of fear. And it's interesting to think about fear, the potency that fear has as a force. And of course, when we are fearful for maybe misguided reasons or simplistic reasons, it's something that really undermines the common good. On the other hand, it's not that we shouldn't be fearful at all, that there aren't things that we should legitimately fear. How would you have us as a nation and each of us individually sort out this matter of fear and of what to be fearful?
I think there's a distinction between fear and concern, between anger and grievance, if you will. Fear is a disorienting emotional state. Concern is a rational assent to the idea that there is something that requires work, requires reform, requires preservation, whatever it is. Fear is a state that leads us to an anxiety that we're on the precipice, that things are going to fall apart. Edmund Burke wrote that there's nothing more, nothing creates more unreasoning than fear. And fear creates an atmosphere in which really we can overreach, we can do things that are not true to who we are at our best. Being concerned is a natural state of any human moment, actually, but certainly in the life of a republic. So, again, not saying that there's not plenty to worry about, but the great thing about the American Revolution, the great thing about the enduring American system, is that it created a space for reason to have a chance against passion in the arena. And I fear, I'm anxious right now that we are too often putting our chips on passion rather than reason.
When you look back at our history and some of these critical moments in which we were deeply divided and with the very real potential of being really torn asunder, you point in many cases to presidents who very much rose to the occasion and led the nation in a more positive, radiant direction. And in some cases, presidents who, in a sense, defied their own personal backgrounds, their own personal histories, mm-hmm. and in a sense, rose to the occasion in a way that probably perhaps even surprised themselves. Can you give one or two examples of what I'm talking about?
Well, the two most recent examples that are most vivid are Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson on the question of civil rights and race. And Truman came from a border state. His family, part of his family, had been Confederates, quite sympathetic to the secessionist cause. And he used racial slurs in private to the end of his life. But when he became president in April 1945, he really decided that he had become the president of all the people and that his obligation was to try to extend the protections of the Bill of Rights, the promise of the Constitution and the Declaration to all Americans, integrating the military and launching the first significant civil rights program. Roughly the same thing happened to Lyndon Johnson when he became vice president and president in November 1963. Johnson had been a white Southern senator. He had not been a big fan of civil rights because of political reasons. And yet he decided in the wake of Dallas and the cataclysm of the assassination that he was going to pass John Kennedy's civil rights bill and not change a comma. And as people reflected on why was it that he was taking this great risk right before a national election in 1964, Johnson said, well, what the hell is the presidency for if not to do the big things that other men might not do?
I think your book is not just saying that we, because of good fortune or divine providence or whatever, just happen to have the right presidents at the right time to lead us out of lead us through and out of some of our darkest chapters. But it isn't just that, how fortunate we have been as a nation, that we had an Abraham Lincoln or a Harry Truman or a Lyndon Johnson at certain points to confront some of these really dark and difficult issues, but that also there is something about our nation itself that has made this possible, and that another nation might not have had the wherewithal collectively to, in a sense, recover from such moments mm-hmm. of deep division. What is it about our country, and in particular maybe the way in which we began and the way in which we've grown, that have allowed us to have as a nation, at least to varying degrees, this quality?
Yeah, well, you put your finger on it. We're the only nation in the world founded on an idea, not on ethnicity, not on race, not on religion, but on the idea that fair play, we're born equal, we should have the right to rise as far as our merits and talent can take us. And anyone coming from anywhere who assents to that idea and joins the covenant that the best way to guarantee fair play for yourself is to guarantee it for other people, that's the animating American principle. We have not lived up to it at every moment, to say the least, but by and large, we've done well enough that our immigration issue is that people want to come here, not that they want to leave. And I think that's we have to keep in mind, what is it about the United States that makes us different, that makes us a place where you and I'm sure, and most of the people we know would do anything to defend it and preserve it. And that is a devotion to fair play and the sense that if you have the ability, if you have the ambition, you should be able to do as well as your talents can take you.
One thing I appreciated from the book's introduction, because I think most people are thinking most about some of the rather dramatic things and insightful things you have to say about some of our past presidents, in contrast to our current president. But this is a book not only about that, but about others who have helped make a difference at these crucial points in our history. You say at one point in the introduction, we are a better nation because of reformers, known and unknown, celebrated and obscure, who have risked and given their lives in the conviction that, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. How do we sort of combine those two ideas, on the one hand, of the significance of a president leading us, and on the other hand, the work of reformers and workers for a good cause, many of whom are completely unknown to the nation as a whole?
Well, this is the nature of a free republic. It requires both. It requires the broad populace moving in the right direction. It requires the leaders who emerge from that populace to abet, not exacerbate, that unfolding story. A republic is only as good as the sum of its parts. Our dispositions of heart and mind individually have a collective effect. Might not have one in an autocracy because power is in the hands of a few, and order is maintained in an autocracy by force and the threat of force. In a republic, the authority is maintained morally. We take part in a society of liberty under law and the rule of law, and we give up certain rights in order to enjoy the broader freedoms. And so there is this mysterious interplay between the people who have power and the people who can only bear witness to the powerful. And at every point, whether it's been emancipation or women's suffrage or civil rights or the broad forces of American liberty, that interplay has taken place.
Mm. A last quick question. So your book is built on the premise that, in a sense, we have been here before, that for all the difficulties that we are facing, this is not an entirely new chapter. This is yet another chapter, and we have visited mm-hmm. these issues before. But so much feels so different about the world in which we now live, and it's changed at such a bewildering pace. But do you remain steadfast in that conviction that this is not a new kind of division that we are seeing? It is just sort of the latest iteration of divisions that we have suffered through before.
I really do. I don't, God willing, there's not large-scale violence in the streets. There is not violence against civil rights workers. There's not Woodrow Wilson, when he was president, launched warrantless raids on dissident homes. Again, none of this is to say, therefore, let's just not worry about what the administration is doing. But it is to argue that we need a sense of proportion. And if we surrender hope, if we say it has never been like this before, because of Twitter, because of the internet, because of cable news, we're never going to get out of it, then that's totally despairing, defeating, dispiriting, and I'm not sure where it leaves us, actually. If you believe the experiment, do people really believe that the American experiment in liberty is going to die in this presidential term? I just don't. And I'm not saying it couldn't, because anything can happen at any time. That's the nature of history. It's a fallen world. But I want us to engage with the past in order to arm ourselves to make sure the experiment endures, no matter what the White House does, no matter what Congress does, no matter what happens.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham is going to be coming to Carthage College this Saturday afternoon, May 26th, for a free public event at 2 o'clock in Siebert Chapel, an event that I am very honored to be emceeing. It's an opportunity to meet John Meacham and even to pose some questions to him. We will primarily be talking about this latest book called The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, published by Random House. Here is an excerpt from the book's introduction. There was a genius about the American founding and the emergence of American democratic politics. That genius lay in no small part in the recognition that the Republic was as susceptible to human passions as human beings themselves. The founders expected seasons of anger and frustration. They anticipated hours of unhappiness and unrest. Fear frequently defies constitutional and political mediation, for it is more emotional than rational. When the unreconstructed Southerner of the late 19th century, or the anti-Semite of the 20th, believed, or the nativist of the globalized world of the 21st century believes others to be less than human, then the protocols of politics and the checks and balances of the Madisonian system of governance face formidable tests. Mediating conflicting claims between groups if one of the groups refuses to acknowledge the very humanity of the others is a monumental task. Our Constitution and our politics, however, have endured and prevailed, vindicating the founders' vision of a country that would require amendment and adjustment, that the nation was constructed with an awareness of sin and the means to take account of societal changes has enabled us to rise above the furies of given moments and given ages. And while those furies sometimes ebb, they also sometimes flow. In a November 1963 lecture that formed the basis of a Harper's cover story and of a book, the Columbia historian Richard Hofstadter defined what he called the paranoid style in American politics, a recurring popular tendency to adhere to extreme conspiratorial theories about threats to the country. He wrote, "The paranoid spokesman sees the fate of conspiracy in apocalyptic terms. He traffics in the birth and death of whole worlds, whole political orders, whole systems of human values. He is always manning the barricades of civilization. He constantly lives at a turning point. It is now or never in organizing resistance to conspiracy. Time is forever running out." The measure of our political and cultural health cannot be whether we all agree on all things at all times. We don't, and we won't. Disagreement and debate, including ferocious disagreement and exhausting debate, are hallmarks of American politics. As Jefferson noted, divisions of opinion have defined free society since the days of Greece and Rome. The art of politics lies in the manufacturing of a workable consensus for a given time, not unanimity. This is an art, not a science. There is no algorithm that can tell a president or a people what to do. Like life, history is contingent and conditional. A portion of the introduction to John Meacham's marvelous book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Again, he speaks at Carthage College this Saturday afternoon, 2 o'clock in Siebert Chapel, a public event, free and open to all of you. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD, and now from the Morning Show archives, one of my past conversations with John Meacham about one of his earlier books. Our focus for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show on this President's Day is our third president, Thomas Jefferson, certainly a figure of great renown and of some controversy. In fact, it seems that as long as time passes, the figure of Thomas Jefferson, in a sense, becomes more controversial or a more divisive figure. And he is a complicated man. And author, historian John Meacham does not shy away from that complexity in the book which he has just written, a New York Times bestseller, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John Meacham is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for his extraordinary portrait of an extraordinary man, our seventh president, Andrew Jackson, the book American Lion. And I first had the pleasure of speaking with John Meacham about his bestseller called Franklin and Winston, a very discerning look at the relationship between and friendship between Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. John Meacham is an executive editor and executive vice president of Random House Publishing, and for many years contributing editor to Time Magazine, once a former editor of Newsweek Magazine as well. And he is a well-known figure that I'm sure you've seen his writing many places and seen him on television as well. Again, we are talking about his newest book called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John Meacham, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. We do. We go way back.
I'm so glad to have this opportunity to speak with you again. Speaking of...
This is 10 years to the year.
Wow.
Well, I kind of went to 03.
Well, speaking of going back, I am sort of struck by the difference between writing a book about, for instance, Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, where you conceivably could have spoken, I don't remember now, but you could conceivably could have spoken to people who knew both of those men, or certainly were close to them in one way or another. When one reaches back to the early 19th century, to someone who died in 1826, I should think it is a profoundly different experience. Tell us what is challenging about reaching back to a figure like Andrew Jackson, or even earlier, to a figure like Thomas Jefferson.
Well, you're exactly right. The interviews are harder to get. they require, you know, Henry Wallace and mediums. What's complicated about it is, well, it's at once, like everything, it's at once more complicated and more simple, because you are confronted with this vast documentary record, particularly in Jefferson's case, more than 22,000 letters, and you know, and the all the scholarship, all of the contemporary letters from the early Republic. He played a major role in basically every political event of note, roughly from the time he went to Philadelphia in 1775 as a delegate to the Continental Congress, really until he died. So through the Missouri Compromise up to the presidency of John Quincy Adams. So it's an enormous life, and a little bit like Churchill's in that way, in that he had a hand in so many things. What one has to do is really read, not between the lines necessarily, but always read in context what these daily letters were like. Because, you know, for the 18th and 19th century, their letters were like our phone calls, or our emails now, I guess. They were expressions of the thoughts of a moment. And oftentimes, you know, we tend to privilege, to use that term, anything written as a clearly thought out, firmly held belief. With someone like Jefferson, he was restlessly intellectual. He was relentlessly curious, prolific letter writer. Anything that struck him, he would write a letter. And because he was so eloquent, these things sometimes slip into the secondary literature as Jeffersonian convictions, when, in fact, the task for someone like me is to go back and try to recreate what was going on that week, what was happening that day that made him so pro-French or so anti-Adams or whatever it would be. And so, in a way, it's more of a detective story. The farther back you go, because you're dealing with a written trail of clues, as opposed to the more contemporary figures, where you're right, you can more easily capture the sense and smell of a room. I think I interviewed the last 11 or 12 people who had been in the room together with Roosevelt and Churchill. And they'd all been younger, obviously, children, young age. But they were still very tactile, very human to them. With Jefferson, with Adams, with Washington, you know, you're using a documentary record to recreate the world.
And of course, as you've already touched on, Thomas Jefferson was a man, in a sense, riddled with contradictions. And it to phrase it that way is, in a sense, to cast it in a really maybe more negative light than is necessary. But, I mean, the fact remains that for someone who is trying to paint a rich, full portrait of the man, that's one of the biggest challenges. The fact that, I suppose most human beings are complicated, but is it fair to say Thomas Jefferson was more complicated than most?
You know, I sometimes say politicians are like all of us, only more so. And Jefferson is very much like that. He was riddled with contradictions is a totally fair way to put it. He was capable of a level of cognitive dissonance of holding two opposing ideas in his head at an epic level. But I would argue that many great political leaders, many people who have been in the arena constrained by time and chance, yet trying to move things forward in a certain direction amid the conflicting forces of our time, many of those politicians have had these kinds of contradictions. Jefferson is epic in this sense because his were so fundamental. No one articulated the promise of America more brilliantly or more evocatively than Thomas Jefferson. President Obama's inaugural address a few weeks ago was shot through with Jeffersonian language, and Obama didn't even have to quote him. People just knew it. When you talk about all men are created equal, when you talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, nobody thinks you're talking about James Madison or Alexander Hamilton or John Adams or George Washington. They know you're talking about Jefferson. So he was this immensely prophetic, eloquent figure. So he articulated the best we could be. But he also showed us what we all too often are, which is flawed, sinful, and falling short of those ideals. And one of the things that I found so fascinating in doing this book was James Part, a great 19th century biographer who'd also written about Andrew Jackson, wrote at the end of his Jefferson book in the early 1870s, I think. He said, if America is right, then Jefferson is right. But if Jefferson was wrong, then America is wrong. You know, that's a hell of a burden to put on any one person. You don't hear that about Washington. You don't hear that about Hamilton. You don't hear that about Adams. You don't hear that about Madison. There's something about Jefferson in his vividness of character, in his, I think, really self-evident, to use Benjamin Franklin's edit from the Declaration of Independence, his evident struggles with the ideal and the real, that makes him resonate from age to age. He's the one founder that I would really like to sit and have dinner with. I'd love to meet the rest of them, obviously. But if I had to choose, I would want to talk to Jefferson, in part because you could talk about anything. And I think that, that's part of the reason he still lives in our imaginations.
We're speaking today with John Meacham, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, talking about his newest bestseller called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. You just touched on something I was so anxious to ask you about, as you just now talked about balancing the ideal with the real. One of the things that leapt out from me as I read your book was two notions of Thomas Jefferson. First of all, that he was, on the one hand, a very cerebral sort of figure, and on the other hand, a real pragmatist. And I think most of us think of those as two different universes, or at least two different solar systems, or maybe two different planets, but we don't often think of someone being intensely cerebral and a pragmatist, able to get things done. And to whatever extent that is rare, a rare duality to find in one person, we find that in Thomas Jefferson. How did he manage to be both of those things?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that duality, which is a wonderful way to put it, I think is the hallmark of our greatest leaders. And one thing, a game to play, if you're having a dorky night where you need a game, is can you think of a great American leader who did not have that duality? That is, who could not project a vision of a better future, of an optimistic vision of the country, of what the country could be, while also possessing the legislative and practical skills to bring that ideal closer to reality. Lincoln could do it. FDR could do it. John Kennedy could do it. Ronald Reagan could do it. Bill Clinton could do it. But they're not, when you think about it, Jefferson, when you think about it, they're, as you say, they're not exactly natural allies, because to project a vision, prophets can do that, priests, philosophers, intellectuals, there are people who can see forward and inspire, and then there are the purely legislative mechanics. You know, there are the people who can fix things. We get great leaders when we get people who are skilled in both those arts. That's what I call the art of power. And in the book is that the art of this, and it's not a science, it is an art, is being able to project an ideal and having the skills to bring it closer to reality. And Jefferson, from age to age, was able to do that. It was one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is I believed that in the popular mind, Jefferson either was seen as a hopelessly irredeemable slave owner. You know, that's where the post-war scholarship, post-World War II scholarship largely was. Or this kind of airy philosopher, the man of Monticello, who was, you know, inventing telescopes, and, you know, he was sort of Galileo with a Virginia accent. You know, there was a kind of sense that he was not attached to reality, which is partly the way he wanted to be seen. You know, the tombstone that says he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the founder of the University of Virginia, I think is one of the great acts of misdirection in American history, because he wanted to be remembered for these noble intellectual achievements, because he figured there would be less controversy about those than anything he had done in his political life. Yet, from 1769 until 1809, for those biblical 40 years, he was almost constantly in public office. But he knew that politics was inherently controversial, and he didn't like controversy. So, in a weird way, he was ambivalent about what he was best at. But a lot of people, I know a lot of people who are like that, you know, who are really good at something, and because they're really good at it, they don't value it. And that's a question for everyone's psychiatrist, but it's a it is a reality, it's a human characteristic. I think that the ability to be either an idealistic realist or a realistic idealist is an incredibly important American political skill.
When we are looking at Thomas Jefferson, we of course are looking at such a fascinating part of our nation's history. And not just that those turbulent times in which our nation first took shape and began its life, but those first years of the United States of America, in which there is a painful divide politically, that a lot of us today still do not begin to really understand. Help us understand sort of that basic divide in governance that marks so much of the very first years of the 19th century, and where Jefferson fell in terms of that divide.
Well, it's exactly right. It's if you don't understand the that division that sprung up most vividly in the 1790s, then American history doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I think in the popular mind, we go from 1776 to the Constitutional Convention, and then pretty soon it's Fort Sumter. And that's understandable. I mean, we all condense things. The critical division that became very apparent in 1790, the first full year of the Washington administration. Washington had taken office on April 30th, 1789. Jefferson has returned from France, become Secretary of State. Hamilton has become the Secretary of the Treasury. Adams is Vice President. They go to war, Hamilton and Jefferson, as Jefferson put it, like two cocks in a pit. You know, they were just constantly at each other's throats. And the questions were about the role of the federal government, the role of the financial sector, the fight between strict construction of the Constitution and a broader construction. They divided pretty quickly into what were known as Federalists, which was the more of the Washington, Hamilton, Adams party, and the Republicans, who were not the Republicans of Lincoln, but the first Republicans, which was Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Gallatin, who were more oriented toward France and decentralized power, whereas the Federalists were more oriented toward centralized power and Britain. My belief, my argument, is that the fear of a British return to power, of a British reconnaissance mission on the American experiment, was the driving political force in Thomas Jefferson's political imagination in the 1790s. And that the war itself, the American Revolution, should be seen, in my argument, not as a 5-6 year war that ran from 76 to 82, 83, but a 50-year war that was sometimes hot, sometimes cold, sometimes quite present, sometimes latent, but always there, really from 1763 and the end of the French and Indian War, all the way through the Treaty of Ghent and the end of the War of 1812 and 1815. Now, the good thing about that argument is the British did come back, so Jefferson wins the argument. In fact, there did have to be a ratifying conflict to make sure that the British monarchy would not attempt to reclaim its colonies, which, when you think about it, why wouldn't they try? Right? It was a damn miracle that the American Revolution went the way it did militarily anyway. But that question, the question of would we be more open, more cooperative with London, or would we ally ourselves more with Paris, was a central question in the life of the Republic and totally defined our politics. A lot of people don't realize that foreign policy was that important. But for Jefferson and Hamilton, foreign policy was so intimately connected to domestic policy, since we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if the country was going to make it. Mm. Nothing like it ever had. So it was a reasonable fear.
Your book, of course, begins in such dramatic fashion early in 1801, on the eve of what ultimately, of course, becomes the two-term presidency of Thomas Jefferson. But this is a moment in time, of course, when there is very much a question hanging in the air of who is going to be the third president. As you describe this very, very unsettling moment, not only in the life of Thomas Jefferson, but in the life of this young nation, you say that now a quarter century after the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson believed that the United States, as he knew it and loved it, might not long endure. And, of course, here we are now in the year 2013 in the United States of America. We know full well that, rough times or not, the U.S. ultimately does endure. It's probably really important to try to put ourselves back into the mind of someone like Thomas Jefferson at this point in our history when the future is so much more tenuous.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the reasons to look at history, to think about biography, is to achieve a sense of proportionality. You know, how does the crisis of the present moment stack up against crises of the past? It's one of the reasons I do this, is to try to get some sense of, you know, is the debt ceiling battle really Fort Sumter or the election of 1801, or is it something else? And without that perspective, I don't think there's any way to really rationally try to move forward. Jefferson dealt with existential crises his whole life because he was, in fact, part of a generation that was creating something new. He said in a letter to Joseph Priestley after that very narrow election in 1801, which he almost lost, not with the people, but in Washington. He almost lost it with, there was confusion in the Electoral College. His own running mate was essentially running against him, Aaron Burr. There was talk that they might make John Marshall, then the Chief Justice and the Secretary of State, he was sort of concurrently serving, might make him president for a year until they could work it out. We now have the sense that, of course, every 4 years we have this orderly transition. Well, that was only the second contested election. 1796 was the first contested election. Adams won. 1800 was only the second. And it took 36, 37 ballots in the House of Representatives before Jefferson won. So the whole thing was tenuous. You know, as Wellington said of Waterloo, it was the damnedest close-run thing you ever saw in your life. And I think that at least in, for me anyway, trying to understand how close we came to disaster or what went into averting disaster is incredibly useful in the broadest sense in understanding what we're supposed to be doing, what we ought to be doing now. Not that there's a way to, you know, send for Jefferson to deal with a debt ceiling. That's anachronistic. I don't mean that. But if we don't understand how the earlier generations fought these battles, then I don't think we're ever going to be able to judge exactly where we stand in terms of the level of crisis and the level of difficulty that we face.
Hmm. You say quite firmly that Thomas Jefferson was the most successful political figure of the first part of the 19th century, both for his own presidency and so many presidents who followed after him, who very much followed in his footsteps, politically speaking. Among many fascinating areas that we could discuss, but with our time just about gone, I'm choosing just one for no particular reason. But I think if we just talk for a moment or two about it, it'll give listeners a sense of all the richness of your book and of this portrait. One of the most intriguing things about Thomas Jefferson is his religious faith, or lack thereof, or what I think you at one point term a rather kind of unconventional belief system for that time and place. And this has been one bone of contention in understanding who he was and the way in which different people have reacted to Thomas Jefferson, to some extent, hinges on this. Would you mind just saying a word about this Sure. complicated facet of Thomas Jefferson?
Absolutely. He was, that's exactly right. He was an unconventional believer, but he was a believer. He believed in a creator God. He believed, interestingly, in a system, a future system of rewards and punishments. He believed in a kind of consciousness of the soul. He thought that he and John Adams are up there right now, wherever there is, looking down, listening to us, which would please Jefferson immensely and Adams not so much. So there was a kind of Aristotelian sense of that. He was in no way a Christian in the way we would think of it. He did not think that the creeds of the church that came up and rose out of the understanding of the life of Jesus of Nazareth were legitimate. He called it monkish superstition. He called the Holy Trinity the mere abracadabra of men calling themselves the priests of Jesus. He tried to create his own Bible. You know, presidents have very few ego problems, but no one else has ever tried to rewrite the New Testament. But Jefferson did, to try to remove the superstitious elements, the mystical elements, and try to recover what he believed to be the moral philosophy at the heart of the Jesus story. It would be almost impossible for Jefferson to win an election today with those religious views. He was much more of a seeker in many ways, of a intellectual about the role of faith. But he did appreciate, and this is an important point, he did appreciate the cultural role of faith as something in the life of a republic that held it together. And so his great goal in fighting for religious liberty was to make sure religion was only one factor among many in shaping the life of the country, that it would never become dominant, but at the same time, you would never persecute people simply on religious grounds.
Hmm. At one point early in the book, you write, Jefferson was a breathing human being who was subject to the passion and prejudice and pride and love and ambition and hope and fear that drive most other breathing human beings. And, of course, as you go on to say, the whole aim of your marvelous book is to try to paint a rich, vibrant portrait of exactly that, Thomas Jefferson as a human being. The book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, published by Random House, and its author, John Meacham. John Meacham, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule to talk with me about this really fascinating book, and I thank you again for writing it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham is coming to Carthage this weekend, and there is a public event at which he will speak, an event that I'm very honored to be emceeing, this Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock in Siebert Chapel. The event is free.